I'll call a meeting of the Property Tax Measure Review Committee to order, and welcome. We will start with roll call.
Representatives, Chairman.
Here.
Ballou. Belter. Bo.
Here.
Gamson.
Here.
Proseth.
Here.
Kingsbury.
Here.
Koppelman.
Here.
Metcalf.
Here.
Ruby.
Here.
Williams.
Here.
Winrich.
Here.
Zizer. Senators Elke.
Here.
Cook.
Here.
Miller.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Sarvad.
Here.
You have a quorum, Mr. Chairman?
Thank you. We have consideration minutes of the November 2nd meeting. Is there any discussion? Corrections? Removal to approve is a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion carries. The minutes are approved. First order of business is presentation by representative of the Tax Department regarding the estimated fiscal impact of initiated Measure 2. And I do remind everybody that it is April 2nd today, not April 1st. So there's no April Fool's joke today.
Now is it on? Okay. I'm Catherine Strombeck, Research Analyst with the Office of Tax Commissioner. I'm here this morning to talk to you about the estimated fiscal impact of the initiated measure. Do you all have a copy? I tried to get all of your desks. I won't be reading the whole thing this morning, but I did want to start with just a couple of the opening paragraphs here. The Office of State Tax Commissioner, at the request of Legislative Council, has estimated the fiscal impact of the initiated measure. This measure, if enacted by a vote of the people, will repeal ad valorem property taxes effective January 1, 2012. The amount of property taxes that will be eliminated by a successful passage of the measure is estimated to be $812,225,000 for 2012. This estimate assumes the effective date of the measure, if approved by the voters, will be interpreted to initially impact and repeal 2012 property taxes that would be due and payable in 2013. It is assumed that 2011 property taxes due and payable in 2012 will be interpreted to not be repealed by the measure. So that's crucial to our estimate here. And I'd like to go through some of the other assumptions that we've made in computing this fiscal impact. All of these assumptions are consistent with a memo that John Walstead presented to the committee at one of your prior meetings. The major piece of the fiscal estimate is the general ad valorem property tax component, which is estimated to be just under $830 million. This is the regular ad valorem property taxes on residential, commercial, agriculture, and centrally assessed properties. The amount of this estimate was established by following a simple linear trend line, which has been averaging about 7.7% growth per year. To this, we've added the in lieu of property taxes that are based on property valuation. This includes items like National Guard land, State Game and Fish land, land acquired by the Water Commission, the Board of University and School lands, and farm and ranch land owned by nonprofits for conservation purposes. These in lieu of taxes are in place of property taxes and they're based on property valuations, and they act exactly like ad valorem taxes, so we assume they go away with the measure. In lieu of taxes that are not based on property valuation are assumed to stay in place and are not part of this fiscal estimate. And those are things like the oil and gas gross production tax, the coal conversion tax, telecommunications gross receipts tax, and the electrical generation distribution and transmission tax. They are not part of the fiscal estimate. They are assumed to stay in place. Next, we added the special taxes on mobile homes. Mobile homes are not subject to property taxes, but are subject to a special tax. It is assumed that that special tax would go away with the passage of the measure. From this, we subtract bond repayments. There are seven separate levies for bond repayments, including two for cities, one for counties, one for townships, and one for parks. There were 62 separate political subdivisions that levied for these bond repayments in 2010. Therefore, there are approximately 62 government entities that will continue to levy ad valorem property taxes until the bonds are repaid. And all of this, if you add that all up, it equals our estimate of $812,225,000. Again, it is assumed that the measure, if enacted, impacts only 1 year in the 2011-2013 biennium. In subsequent biennia, 2 years will be impacted. So just a quick rough estimate for the 2013-2015 biennium, this measure, if enacted, would reduce property taxes in that biennium of about $1.8 billion. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have for my prepared comments. I will certainly be happy to attempt to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Remick. Does the committee have any questions? Representative Ruby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Strombeck, the assumptions on the taxes in lieu of taxes, were they the assumptions of the department or assumptions of John Walstead's testimony from the previous meetings?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ruby, they're consistent with John's estimates, John Walstead's estimates, but the department does agree for the most part too. I believe there's a November 2011 memo, and you'll find basically all those assumptions in that memo.
And one more, Mr. Chairman.
You may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That 7.7% increase, is that the trend even after the reduction that the legislature put in with the school?
Mr. Chairman, that is a trend, and that's a good point. That is the one assumption that is not in John's memo. What that is a simple linear trend, and that is the trend after. I mean, we have a fairly actively growing state right now, and that has been our trend after the mill levy reduction program.
Thank you.
Ms. Strombeck, you quoted this as the property tax based on 2011 collections. So earlier we were told that we're based on the 2010, but this is based on 2011. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, it is an estimate for 2012, actually. That would be due and payable in 2013. It's based on our most recent history right now is 2010. We're in the process of getting 2011, but it is an estimate of 2012.
Is there any other questions by the committee? Representative Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, Kathy, the $350 million that we spend right now to buy down property taxes, that's not included in this, is that correct? Well, that is included.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it is not included. It is assumed that this is the property tax that we currently collect, so it would be net of the 75 mil buy down. So that is a biennial, well, an approximate biennial number. That would be in addition to this, except that is assumed that the state would continue to pay that.
So the number's going to be larger than that then?
Well, that depends on what the legislature does, Senator. Yeah.
And then just one other question.
Let me continue.
John's memo, I think, also talked about bonded indebtedness that's not general obligation indebtedness, and that there was, a question out there as far as to what degree is property tax still has to be collected to pay that off, should there be a default in the revenue, etc. You didn't consider any of that?
Mr. Chairman, no. This is the bonded indebtedness that we considered were the 62 levies for in the ad valorem property tax piece for bonded indebtedness only.
In our TIF, if I may, and I don't know if you can answer this, but TIF district bonds, those are revenue bonds, I would assume, not general obligation bonds.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I honestly can't answer that. Marcy is in the room. She might be able to.
Well, I'm going to make the assumption that they are, unless somebody wants to correct me. I didn't say they're not, but I would assume they are.
Okay.
Yeah. Is there any other questions from the committee? Representative Ruby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was kind of wondering about, this is overall taxes collected, but we had heard in the past that there was a portion of taxes that, the funds it takes to collect that tax. But since that's not removed, that is part of this as well. So by funding all that, without removing that, it's actually a pretty good increase to the counties. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Chairman, what this estimate is the total ad valorem property taxes. Certainly embedded in there is the cost of collecting those. that isn't really addressed. The measure simply gets rid of property taxes, and so all of that is assumed to go away in this estimate.
That could be a 50 million, we've heard the number 50 million, that could be a $50 million increase to the counties that they wouldn't need to apply to collecting taxes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm probably not the best person to talk to about that. Maybe there's a representative of counties in the room, I'm not sure.
Ms. Strombach, in regard to the $22 million bond indebtedness, that is collected through property tax valuation currently. And the measure, if I remember correctly, eliminates the ability for the counties, political subdivisions to, there's no language from how they can collect it or how we can enforce that. Is that correct? So they'll have to be put in place language to give them the ability to continue to collect?
Mr. Chairman, there may be some need for that language, but in John Walstead's memo, the assumption errs on the side of contracts, existing contracts. And so it was his opinion that the court would eventually find that those contracts supersede the measure and stay in place. Now, that may mean there still needs to be some language to enable that to happen. But in the fiscal note, we have assumed that all that falls into place and bonded indebtedness continues to be collected through an ad valorem property tax for the 10 or 15 years or whatever.
Representative Windrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kathy, there was also, a note, as I recall, in Mr. Walstead's memorandum that indicated that were a municipality to approve a bond issue between January 1st, 2012 and the effective date of this legislation, that would kind of be in limbo. We really didn't know what would happen to that. Did your study indicate whether any of that has happened, or are all municipalities just holding off?
Mr. Chairman, I believe all municipalities are holding off. Again, if there's a representative in the audience, maybe you can clarify that, but I believe that is the case, that when the signatures were successfully gathered, that all of that bonding action stopped, I believe.
Thank you.
Is there another question? Representative Damson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the administration of present taxes being eliminated, I'm under the impression or understanding that specials would not be affected, special assessments would not be affected by the passage of this measure. Would we not need the mechanism in place to administer the collection of those special assessments? I mean, can we really assume that $50 million will not be an expenditure?
Mr. Chairman, that's certainly a very good point. Special assessments are left in place by the measure, and there would definitely need to be some mechanism at the local level, at the county level, to continue to impose special assessments. That's a good point.
Mr. Strombach, a question I have, another question I have on the bonded indebtedness. A lot of times that bonded indebtedness, when it is voted on, is done for improvements to draw new businesses, new houses, new construction into an area. And the payback is based on the growth of that area. If Measure 2 passes, the political subdivisions are going to be able to add that growth in to help pay for all indebtedness, or are they going to be froze at the level as of January 1st, 2012?
Mr. Chairman, the assumption is that they would be able to, that ad valorem taxes for that taxing jurisdiction would continue for the length of the bond, and as growth occurred in that political subdivision, it too would be appraised and levied these for bond repayments, these seven levies for bond repayments.
Well, then it appears we need to have in place people that can appraise this and be able to build for that additional growth.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I would think so. I would agree.
Is there any other questions of the committee? You must have done a great job, didn't you?
Everybody's tired.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I hope that you'll stay around in case we do all of a sudden come up with some questions. Then we'll ask for comments from interested people in the In the audience, who would like to comment on testimony and questions so far? Good morning, Mr. Hale.
Morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Hale, with Empower the Taxpayer. We'd just like to make a couple of observations here today. A year ago this month, Empower the Taxpayer brought 28,000 plus valid signatures to put this measure on the ballot and is responsible for this committee today. Shortly thereafter, you were established and charged with two primary responsibilities, as we understand it. One is as to what laws need to be put in place to implement Measure 2 upon its passage. I'd like to quote from one of the members of this committee on November 17th of last year. And since that date, I don't see any change. It says, "Well, Dan and I are both on the committee that's responsible to come up with the fiscal effects of this bill and then also to come up with some sort of idea of what the century code might or what the law might look like or what the plan would be. I don't believe the committee's intent is to go down that road unless the bill passes. I believe that the committee hasn't gone down that road, therefore hasn't done this up to this point in time. I don't know what its plans are from this date forward." The second item has to do with what the tax department talked about today, and the tax department came in and identified what it estimates property tax collections are going to be in the future. And that is one half of the equation to identify the economic impacts, the fiscal impact of Measure 2. The other side, however, is what those impacts are going to be to the state economy. The tax department testified before this committee and submitted verbal and written testimony that they do not have the expertise or the capabilities within their office to address and identify what the impact of the economic happening in this state with the abolition of property taxes will be. We know that's going to put, according to the tax department, approximately $800 million a year into the private economy. We also know, based upon what many members of this committee have approved in legislative action for economic development agencies, which argue that by abolishing property taxes, abating property taxes, creating economic enterprise zones, etc., all of which take away property taxes, this allows those businesses to have that money to invest, and that investment results in local sales, state sales, income tax, and other tax revenues that more than make up for the taxes abated. That portion of the equation has not been addressed. We've repeatedly asked this committee, verbally and in writing, to have that addressed since the tax department doesn't have the expertise to do it. This committee, as of this day, has refused to do so. We believe that the information presented, if presented as the fiscal impact of Measure 2, is what's given to the public. They are being improperly informed as to what this is, and this committee has failed to perform either of the two major functions it was assigned. I would hope that from this day forward, it undertakes and addresses both of those issues. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hale. Another comment I will make towards that is that the necessary laws that will have to be imposed will not be worked on until we will not waste our taxpayers' dollars proposing legislation until we know it's needed. We are not going to sign a dime at the end of this meeting. If Measure 2 passes, we will be back and we will address the necessary legal changes. I think we do have somewhat of an understanding of the effect it's going to have. For instance, the collection of property tax for bonding purposes, and that we will have to address that if Measure 2 does pass. And as far as the second part of it, the fiscal note, I believe we have completed that portion of it so that we can give to the Secretary of State, upon approval of legislative management, a report that gives the effect of the dollars that will no longer be collected by the political subdivisions of the state of North Dakota, and that the state of North Dakota will be replacing with other revenue, either existing revenue or new taxes that depending up to the next legislative session. With that, unless somebody else would like to comment on Mr. Hale's remarks, we will continue on with other discussions. Yes, ma'am, state your name, please.
Good morning. I'm a resident over in Mandan, North Dakota. I'd like to say good morning to the chairman and the senators and representatives here, Senator Cook. My name is Susan Buehler, and I am a homeowner, a taxpayer, and resident of Mandan. And as the state of North Dakota, we have a great opportunity in front of us. We can be innovative, or we can be callous towards the needs of our people in our state. As you heard in testimony from the tax department, she said that it's on an upward scale, the property tax, 7.8%. I don't get a 7.8% pay raise. I'm a business owner. Every dollar that comes out of my pocket to pay a tax is one less dollar I have to invest in my business. Recently, this last week, Minneapolis, 11:30 a.m. radio said, North Dakota's legislators, they have more balls compared to our wimpy Minnesota legislators. And I say the people here in North Dakota need your leadership. They do not like, they need your leadership to tell them if they do not like something in their government, it's perfectly okay that we choose to vote yes on Measure 2 or we choose no to vote on Measure 2. Assure the people that we can come to our legislature and get help. And I feel by not looking fully at the fiscal note and not looking at what this could be a tax savings as far as administration, that's a disservice to the taxpayers. We the people do have a voice, and we elect you to be our voice. You can be champions or you can be wimps. I'm asking you to take the lead and tell the people they have the right to be a part of the system. Acknowledge our right to go to a vote to change the way we do business. Instead of some of the remarks I've heard from legislators and different organizations saying, we're making you work and whining about messes that this would create and hours that you might have to put in there, I say quit doing that. And if the going gets tough, I say put on your big boy and your big girl pants and get on with it. If this is what we want, then it needs to be done. I asked you today, you heard the tax department say the cost to replace that revenue. Within that cost is mill levies that the cities and the local entities take and levy onto their local entities, their local governing bodies level, whatever, the assessed taxes that they charge us as the homeowners or property owners. That includes fire and police, Meals on Wheels, it includes veterans. And I ask as a legislature today that one of you state that if this would pass, you are not going to cut fire and police, you are not going to cut Meals on Wheels, and you're not going to throw veterans under the bus. I asked you today to state that publicly, that you will not be doing that if this measure passes. You need to restore trust. There's a lot of people out there that believe that you, as legislators, are wimps, and you can't handle this. And so I say, prove to them. Prove to them that you can handle this, and you can govern our people. Ensure them that you will abide by their vote. And stop the fear tactics by not being a part of it. State to the people, it's up to you to decide. And you will carry out the wishes if they wish to abolish property tax. I have heard legislation is proposed to discontinue the exemptions for the farmers' homes. I ask you, what are you legislators doing? No! Minnesota legislature is talking of just exempting businesses. I say, don't you get it? This is not about who gets what exemption. It's not about property relief and who gets stuck holding the short end of the deal. This is about real reform and the right to own your property. Century Code in North Dakota, our state legislature has allowed a perpetual lien on our property. Taxes owed is not affected by any statute of limitations, and this lien is exercised if you become delinquent. Currently in the third year of being becoming delinquent. I think it is appalling that murder and property taxes are given the same level enforcement with no statute of limitations. Crimes of rape, child abuse, elder abuse, and even corruption all have statutes of limitations. I'm going to share with you my personal story. I might not look disabled, and I might have a strong voice, and I can speak out. But I have had some big ups and downs in my life. This year, in January, we were 2 years behind on our property taxes. That means that this November, we would have been issued an order to pay, and if we would not have paid, we would have lost our house. I'll tell you why we didn't pay. We had to make a choice between my having a surgery and paying property taxes and all the expenses that go with that, and also having a daughter that's just entering college. So our choice was to delay paying our property taxes. But if for some reason we wouldn't have been able to tap into the funds of our retirement fund, we could have lost our house. Now, is that fair for me to have to make that choice? To make that choice between a decision that will keep me being able to walk or not walk, having my daughter in college or not in college? Those are hard choices that we have to make out here, and it's because of property tax. Our homes should be our homes, not yours, not our cities, not our counties. It should be our home. Did you know, Amanda, we have $100 million debt? $100 million debt. Just went to a meeting last week with our city commissioners. One of the things they did talk about is this bond obligation that you just mentioned here. The financial manager that was present, he stated that with the refunding bonds, that there's no reason that property tax issue should affect them at all, because essentially the city is paying themselves back when they make improvements in their city. He felt that there was no connection to it, and they have decided to move forward with any issues that they have in building more streets. They have decided that this is not going to affect them. And this was through consulting with their bond issuer, Manstrom, I think his name is. But anyway, they have decided to move forward. They're taking a proactive approach and not letting this go, we can't do anything now. They are continuing to go on with their city life. So basically, of that $100 million debt, of that debt, 60% is for roads, and 70% of it is for water and sewer. But it's not benefiting us, the homeowners. It is benefiting the developer that's coming into our city. So of that debt, only $30 million was directly attributed to needs of repairing our streets. I had a hole in my street that was this deep that wasn't being repaired. We could park in it and it would be like this. And so I'm saying that our cities, by only having property tax as their revenue source, as one of the revenue sources, we have tied their hands. You, the legislatures, are just as much a part of the problem because you have given the local governments an ineffective, inefficient way to tax for local services. and that's property tax. It is time to get rid of the beast and stop trying to tame it with relief. It has been over 6 years, I have been trying to do something locally, and our debt has doubled during that time. And many could attest to every meeting I have attended. I have tried to be active locally. It is here in the legislature that you have to take and grab this bull by the horns and do something about it, because it's hurting us. You cannot grow a community on property tax. It's just not possible. You cannot tax a house enough to pay for a $100 million debt. The newcomers in our community, we welcome, and they build new, so they get a tax exemption. The businesses that come into our community, they get a tax exemption. And everyone gets a break except for us loyal ones, the ones that have lived in the city for 20 years. You have the opportunity for this growth knocking at our doors, and we should not have to bang on your door saying we need help out here. Did you know, based on the Association of Counties little report that I pulled off their website, we have 641,000 property tax parcels in North Dakota. If each one of us, just each one of those parcels, paid $1,200, that's $740 million. That would take care of property tax right there. I would much rather be paying that $1,200 than to pay double what I'm paying on my house that isn't even worth $125,000. I live in a modest home. I'm very conservative, but I'm very much for this bill because I think it's an innovative idea, and I think we can pioneer, and I think we can be a legislature that has balls. But if you want to mess around with it and mess around with it, with some kind of property tax relief or not taxing this group or taxing this group, you're just taking and shifting it around. I say it's an untamable beast, and these are the reasons. I'm going to give you reasons that I have found that the property tax is so dysfunctional. One, Fargo gives out about 44% in discretionary exemptions when you compare it to the property tax collected. That means they, if they collect $12 million, they're giving out $6 million in taxes that they're not having paid. They're cutting off their funding by giving out exemptions. These Fargo's exemptions are decided by a committee, which does not keep minutes, which I believe is illegal under our Open Meetings Record Act. Dickinson has a guy that moved here from Colorado who does not know how to find exemptions in his computer program. Actually, he could not find any of his documents or requested, and he seemed like a nice guy. It's just that he didn't know how to find anything, and he could not give me one document. Williston continued to give exemptions and incentives up until December.
Mr. Miller, can I remind you that we are working, the testimony is to be an estimated fiscal impact, and I understand where you're coming from, and it's a good speech for the public, but we are discussing the fiscal impact, and we try to keep your comments to the fiscal impact.
Well, I guess when we're talking about fiscal impact, it impacts my life. It impacts me fiscally. And if you don't want me to go through all this, I can hand it to you as written testimony too. But there's 13 more points where I point out where there's severe dysfunctions in our tax system, and it's throughout the whole state. We got rid of personal property tax back in 1969. And again, at that time they said it was a 20% of the fiscal impact that was going to have on these local communities. And the sky did not fall. The personal property tax was about 20% for those revenues. Right now, Fargo, their revenue that they get from property tax is 24%. So our communities are not going to fall apart if this passes. I know you can say it's going to be so messy and so difficult, but you guys have the chance to be wimps, or you can have the balls to change it, and North Dakota will be legendary. Please help the people, the property taxpayers of North Dakota. The choice is yours to be wimps or to be champions. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I ask the committee for questions, Ms. Beal, am I saying your last name correct?
Beal.
First, let me say we're glad that the surgery was successful.
Thank you.
That you are able to stand. The only comments I'd like to make on it is that I think we as legislators have shown that we want to give the people the right to vote on Measure 2, because we have sanctioned an attorney to oppose this Board of Higher Education who is trying to eliminate the vote on the Measure 2. So I think we have shown a backbone to make sure that the people get heard on how they feel on Measure Number 2. The other thing on the tax exemption, the farmers you mentioned, that is not, this committee has not received any information. That is not anything we're dealing here. That will be dealt in another committee and will be dealt with at the next legislative session. And it's nothing but speculation now. So it really has nothing to do with the argument here. As far as the comments on fire and police, no fire and police, I believe the comments that were made regarding no fire and no police, the comment was that there's nothing in Century Code that currently says that that's a legal obligation, obligation. That doesn't mean that anybody is interested in eliminating those. It's just pointing out that we do not have a definition for what's legally obligated to these political subdivisions. And the tax exemptions that you quoted on these new homes and new businesses, whatever it happens to be, that of course is something that the legislature, we as legislatures have no say in whatsoever. Those exemptions are given to the local subdivisions. And many legislatures have also expressed a lot of concerns at the exemptions over the years in different communities. But we understand your point very much. So now, is there any questions from the committee towards Ms. Beal? Senator Cook?
Mr. Chairman, just one comment about Van Dansstedt. I searched that, I think, during the last session. I'm speaking from memory. Mr. Walstead's got a memo that will be specific, but I believe Van Dansstedt is at $92 million at that time. But the most important thing is what we're talking about here is general obligation bond indebtedness. I believe Van Dansstedt's general obligation bonded indebtedness at that time, it'll be less today, it was $1.2 million, and that was for Van Dansstedt's share of the Memorial Bridge. So, just for the record.
Is there any other questions for the presenter? If not, thank you very much, Ms. Beal. And if you would like to hand out your notes for the committee, we certainly would accept
just
it.
One comment about that exemptions. Those exemptions have been given through the Century Code to the local governments. You do have some control over that. You could add strings to it through the legislature.
Thank you. Any other comments from interested personnel in the audience?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lad Erickson. I'm the McLean County State's Attorney. And I've debated Mr. Hale and Ms. Charlene Nelson on this measure, and I'm not here today to continue that debate. I will correct the record on a couple things that I know are not true. And I can start out with Fargo's tax exemption. Discretionaries are at 4% and they're temporary. And I can give you the statistics on a number of our cities. It's exaggerated to say it's up to 50% across the state and all that stuff. Fargo's was the largest mandate, it's 3%. Most of those are coming off now with that downtown renovation project. Minot's at 1%. It's always exaggerated in this debate. And the evaluations in these cities have increased dramatically, decreasing property tax burdens on people by doing those programs. And I have the emails between the assessors and the supporters of Measure 2 where they tell them what the deal is, but then they go out on the radio and stuff and say it's 50% or 60%. So I just want to start my testimony here today, though. I know that's not on the table, but I wanted to correct that. I know what's on the table here is to create a fiscal note that's accurate for the voters. And I have some concerns about that based on the state of this measure. When you only deal with replacing current property tax values or revenues that are taken. And the reason that I believe that is there are some major cost items with Measure 2 that don't get reflected in that fiscal note. But they're realities that the voters are going to have to face. First of all, we know that if Measure 2 passes, there will be hundreds of millions of additional dollars coming to the legislature to pay the bills for that aren't reflected in current property tax numbers. For example, Bismarck has an $81 million school project for buildings, and they have a $15 million planned annual increase in operating expenses. The school systems in Williston, Dickinson, and other western cities need to double their current capacities, and they have concrete numbers and plans for that. Those numbers are available. On talk radio, in their writings, on their website, and during the debates on Measure 2, the sponsors continually tell the public that you will all be paying these costs. For example, well, in all of the rhetoric, it's about if anybody wants a new jail, a new school, legislature's just going to pay that. As an example of that, Mr. Hale wrote a blog post, and this is what he said. 6 months after being flooded, Minot is still trying to find out how it will fund the rebuilding of Eric Ramstead Middle School and replace Lincoln Elementary. Had Measure 2 been in place, this would not be an issue. Measure 2 requires the state to fund the rebuilding and replacement. The school district would have the authority to decide where and how they wanted the schools to be rebuilt, and the state's responsibility would then be to pay for it. That is what the public believes is being meant to believe about Measure 2 in all sorts of projects. So I do not believe the supporters of Measure 2 would have any standing to be critical of the committee if you take the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in pending projects and have the voters see that on the ballot, because that is the expectation they're being told. The tax department's fiscal note does not show the expectation that the public is getting if they get Measure 2. The public is being led to believe that this is a free ride by this rhetoric. And then when you put the fiscal note on just the replacement costs, you have hundreds of millions of dollars that aren't accounted for that you're going to have to face, and the public's going to expect you to pay for based on the rhetoric if they vote for Measure 2. The second major cost item that I believe the committee should consider in this fiscal note deals with Section 3 of Measure 2, which is our constitutional bonding requirements. As you know, the committee previously took testimony about this, and in November of 2011, the committee got a report from your council. There was some, when people like me say Measure 2 is very poorly worded and poorly thought through, this is one of the sections that I'm talking about. In there, the word taxable is deleted before property, and the word market is put in front of value. What that has the effect of is creating a constitutional requirement for the political subdivisions to assess the personal property of all of our citizens. And at this point, I just want to correct another factual error. It doesn't cost $50 million to implement the property tax system every year. Okay, that's an exaggeration. The real numbers are about $10 million, and those numbers do not go away. If Measure 2 passes, they increase dramatically because of all the assessments of private property, for private personal property. But here is what the Legislative Council staff told you about this provision regarding bonding. It appears the word taxable was removed by the drafters of Measure 2 because upon enactment there will no longer be taxable property. However, removal of the word taxable leaves the word property standing alone, which includes all property. The plain language of this provision appears to require determination of market value of real and personal property, and the measure does not appear to allow any discretion to the Legislative Assembly to exclude any kind of personal property. Literal application of this language would result in an enormous expansion of the assessment responsibilities, costs, and intrusion into what citizens have deemed to be outside the reach of governmental inquiries. This expansion of assessment would serve only a limited purpose of determining bond limits for state and political subdivisions. I believe, Mr. Chairman, that the committee should reflect all of these added millions of dollars in assessment costs that are going to be put on the government to comply with this section, because it's real and it's a constitutional requirement. That, Mr. Chairman, in addition to cost of special sessions, political subdivisions right now all have different budgeting. They're all different. You took a report about the different tax rates across the state. Once the legislature, and this becomes centralized, and the legislature has to try to reconcile a bunch of budgets, that's only going to dramatically increase the cost of government. So what my concern here, Mr. Chairman, today is you are putting on the committee is considering putting on the ballot what it's going to take to replace the current property taxes. But our entire system of government is changing from a diverse system to a centralized system, and the costs of that are going to dramatically increase. And I think that's the cost of voting for Measure 2 that the voters need to see. I will just briefly talk about a couple flaws in the logic that Measure 2 will increase our...
I'm open to a question right now. Would you have a right to hand?
No.
Representative Williams?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, in listening to what you just said, I want to make sure. If this measure were to pass, would, in what you're looking at, the way you're looking at, would the prime exemption be gone?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Williams, yes.
Thank you.
I mean, there wouldn't be any exemptions. There wouldn't be any...
That's what I was hearing.
Let me continue. All right, Representative Woody.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Erickson, if you have an issue with the $50 million figure, I think you should take that up with the county. That was their number, the Association of Counties. I believe that was their number that was first floated out. With your suggestion of including these other costs, would you be opposed to also including the economic benefit of the increased economic activity that is generated by the measure as well?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Ruby, let me answer both questions. Number one, the Association of Counties numbers are 6 million, not 50 million. That is their survey of the townships and counties, and the tax department will add about another 4 million for the cities. How the 50 million is arrived up is by a flawed analysis in what's called the Beacon Hill Report. And on that, the sponsors called three cities and one, in their footnote, I'll just read their footnote so you don't have to believe me. They arrived at the cost of property taxes here's what they say. The cost of property taxes is approximately $25 million a year. Then they double that for a biennium, but then they subtract it when they talk about it, saying it's $50 million a year. And that, they say, according to footnote 10, is based on telephone conversations with officials in Grand Forks, Fargo, West Fargo, and Cass County. Okay, so they called those places and said, well, I'm just going to estimate the whole state at 25. That's where that number comes from, but the scientific number is 10. As far as economic benefit, I wouldn't have a problem putting on fiscal note because there is none. It's negative. Okay, they use a lot of manipulated numbers to say that this is going to increase our economic growth. For example, the way they come up with that is they say if we fire 12,000 state employees, that'll pay for 21% of the measure based on 2010 numbers. The problem is we don't have 12,000 state employees. It's under that. The December OMB report has less than 12,000 state employees. So if you fire every state employee, you're still 21% short of funding the measure. In addition, So they're assuming there wouldn't be any other taxes, but that makes it all new money to make it because you don't have as many employees as they say we should fire. And there's a number of other flaws in that we can get into if you want to ask some more questions.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Just one comment. The committee did not accept the Beacon Hill study as our study, so but those figures were quoted earlier. So I don't know. Representative Ruby.
Yeah, and I think that was just a for instance. That would be one place to, if the state would get the money from that area, that would be one area. But you're right. I mean, there's no way that you would cut that many state employees. It's impossible. But there are other areas that they believe the state could, look at as far as finding the funds. I thought that when Mark Johnson was here, it was a number that he said early in one of our first meetings. It was somewhere in that area. But as far as the $50 million, as far as the economic development impacts, then I don't know if your county does it, but there's a lot of cities and counties that abate taxes to attract businesses, attract people to build houses, all for the supposed future economic benefit for their area. So I guess if, according to your assumption that that doesn't work, and that's flawed as far as what the Beacon Hill Institute document says, we should probably, as a legislature, prohibit the use of any of those kind of practices. Would you agree?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ruby, I think that issue should be looked at when we're in a booming economy. It's a small percentage of actual taxes due abatement. If you go out to vast majority of the cities and counties, they don't have any abatement programs. You'll find some in the bigger areas, like they have a Renaissance Zone. I've been involved with a couple of them, and they were all ones that increased our taxable value. I'll give you two examples. One was, and there's one in Cass County, for example, and that is pending in the whole Cass County outside the city limits, and that's the Tholeson ethanol plant. But here's how you're presented when you're a county guy, okay? Bluefin Ethanol comes in, Great River Energy, they want to build an ethanol plant, and they say, will you give us a five-year tax exemption? Now, our option is to keep that at an agricultural value for 5 years, or competing with other places and other states for that plant. We say, we will give you the five-year break, because all we're doing is continuing to tax at egg rates, and if we don't get the plant, it doesn't cost us anything. Once that plant went in, then, last year our taxing district realized $154,000 in taxes from that project, number of jobs, and all of our corn producers now have a very short trip to market. So there is a role for doing some of that to encourage, but to extend that out and say, well, let's just get rid of all business, all property taxes, then you run into this problem is, how do you replace that revenue? Because one thing you have to remember with commercial businesses that get abatements is they pay a higher tax rate. So once the abatements come off, they're paying more than residents pay in the way the formula works. So if you look, I think this needs, this is a good area of study for the legislature because of the rhetoric here. But what you're going to find is these tools are actually increasing the value of property and decreasing the taxes, not the other way around as it's being portrayed.
Representative
Gretel. Represent Kelch first and then Senator Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Erickson, I just wanted to make sure I understood you properly. Are you saying the language of Measure 2 would say that all property, personal property, has to be evaluated? In other words, like the old personal property evaluation? Whether you got a new bicycle for your kid, or a new bedroom set, all those things?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kiosk, that seems so outrageous that I thought if I just said that, you guys would think I'm crazy. So I quoted your lawyers and the legislative staff language. They're the ones that say that because of how poorly it's written.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how many remember the old personal property assessor, but he was probably the most hated person in the area. And I remember sometimes they'd bring their children along so they wouldn't get abused too bad. And I'm not being facetious. That's what actually happened. I just wanted a clarification on that. Thank you.
Senator Cook?
3 points, Mr. Chairman. And first off, being we're on personal property being assessed, I remember Mr. Walsted reading that memorandum and making it very clear what Mr. Erickson just said, that that would bring into personal property. To have that happen, the legislature would have to pass a law, a bill, that said it would happen. And I don't see the legislature ever doing that. Now, we would subject ourselves, if we did not do it, to somebody who probably wanted to challenge the constitutionality of what we are. But I don't see anybody doing that either. But it is poorly written. On the issue of property tax exemptions, just so this committee knows, there is a tax interim committee chaired by Senator Hoag. At the last meeting, the issue came up. There was requests for bill drafts for that committee to look at that would repeal all current property tax exemptions, all economic development tools. There's suggestions that they need to be reined in. For whatever, wherever that goes, I don't know, but that is a discussion that's happening in another tax committee, just so this committee knows. And on the issue of the fiscal note, all of us in the legislature know what a fiscal note looks like. It's based on mathematical facts. We passed legislation last session that reduced state personal and corporate income tax, I think one by 17, one by 19%. The fiscal note that came with that bill showed a decrease in income tax. It was a mathematical calculation that we presented a fact. We all know what's happening. There hasn't been a decrease in income tax. We have a complete, great increase in property tax. So that one could say that the fiscal note was wrong. We should have made some assumptions. We should have known this was going to come, the economic benefit of it, but that's not how we do fiscal notes. So somehow we need to put some of this to rest, I would hope. We know what a fiscal note looks like, and it's not based on somebody's assumption of what could possibly happen.
Thank you, Senator Cook. And again, I would like to comment that what another committee is discussing is nothing but discussion. It's not fact, and it will not be fact unless the legislature passes it next session. Representative Seizer, I'm not going to be right again this time either, am I?
You got it right. Congratulations. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Erickson, I concur that some of the assumptions made on behalf of the proponents of abolishing the property tax have been embellished and exaggerated. On the other hand, I have some concern. I guess the one I'm most familiar with are some of the tax abatements or exemptions that come in Fargo for the procurement or incentivizing a business. They've not been measured, and they've been given out arbitrarily. I guess I have great concern about how much that's happening throughout the state. And what are your thoughts on that? Or don't you agree with me in terms of the arbitrary nature?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Zizer, I can't speak for a specific. I can tell you, you have a Mr. Hushka there, that's your tax assessor down there, and he does an annual report on those. If you look at your Renaissance Zone, it started at $75 million in value. Now they're taxing $150 million. If you look at Valley City, there's about 20 properties that are exempted there. A lot of those have increased values because they've come off. What you have to look at when you look at those abatements is not the ones that are particularly in the system now, but the tax value of what's come off, and now you can tax at a much higher rate and at a higher formula. And I think that's what Senator Cook's committee is looking at, is what is the, you know, are these arbitrary or not? The other thing you have to remember, and this gets missed in planning and zoning, those businesses sometimes when they come in agree to put in their own sewer or water, they agree to bore through the highways, they agree to put in frontage roads like the Menards or those bigger ones. They pay a bunch of upfront costs, and then they ask planning and zoning that we will we'll pay for all this upfront, okay, but we want a five-year tax break, and then when it comes off, you know. So there's a lot more to it than just saying this isn't fair that they're getting a tax. If you look at the overall evidence, it's an area the legislature should study, but it's not the big boogeyman paranoid conspiracy theory that it's being made out to be.
If I may continue.
Let me remind you that the discussion is on the fiscal impact note that we have to present. A lot of this is going to be debated on the bill itself, whether it should pass or not pass, but that is not what we want to necessarily get into today, so please keep your questions to the fiscal impact.
Okay, with that then, I guess I was going to follow that train of thought. I'll back off then in listening to extinguished chairman.
Thank you. You may continue, Mr. Erickson.
I'll just follow up with what Senator Cook said, and just a brief response, and then I'll end my comments. But I understand what the fiscal note process is, and they're an inexact science. But I just wanted the committee to understand that the public is being promised way more than this fiscal note. You could double this fiscal note and come closer to the truer impact that the public's being processed, being promised if Measure 2 passes, if you start combining all of these costs out there. And I just think the legislature needs to be clear that this fiscal note, how you write it, has no reflection to the reality of the cost of Measure 2 because they're dramatically more. Thank you.
The only comment I would have on that, just a comment on the other presenters, was that our understanding, and we're going to go through this understanding, as presented by our legal counsel, was that the legislature determines how much money they send back, what the legal obligations are, and what the full and proper funding is to those political subdivisions, and that is the legislature will make a decision if a new building is going to be made, not the local subdivisions. And that's a presumption that I'm under. Unless that gets corrected in committee discussion, there will be those additional expenses as you are concerned about.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's right. Measure 2 does destroy local control. The legislature will decide who gets what buildings or whatever. I'm just saying the public is going in with an expectation.
Your note is well taken. Your comments are well taken. Any other questions? Representative Gamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along these lines of the fiscal impact, I think some people maybe don't realize or don't think about the fact that this is not going to take money initially away from the state. It's going to penalize the local governments, local political subdivisions that are, they're going, the ones that levy, assess and levy and collect, sale and spend property tax. So I'm just a little concerned that not everybody understands that. The other issue that I don't think you mentioned is the out-of-state property owners. They are going to be off the hook. Right?
I'm an answer.
Yeah.
Well, again, that doesn't really, I guess the fiscal note, because that's included in it. Well, that's a, so I don't know.
Chairman, I don't necessarily agree with that assertion.
Okay, go ahead and answer the question.
But you're right, it's $126 million a year goes out of state. Okay, if this relief, so that's $126 million a burden that goes on to North Dakotans. So when the tax department puts together those numbers, you already start leaking that money that has to be made up. So it's overestimating, you know, that revenue being replaced there. I mean, it's actually another 126 on top of the 800 million, another 126 million, because those are costs that go directly to the North Dakotans, not the non-residents.
But that is included in 816 million, because that those residents paid in that 816 million is part of what residents paid, non-residents paid in.
That's true.
That would be in our fiscal note.
But well, if Measure 2 passes, you have to find them.
I understand what you're saying.
$6 million.
Is there any other questions? Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope this has to do with the fiscal note. But I just was wondering if anyone could help me out. What percentage of this $812 million is ag land? What percentage are homes? And what percentage is our businesses? I'd like to know that, I guess.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kelch, I can't answer that. The farmer, one of the groups, I think it's the Farmers Union, did some breakdowns like that, but I don't have them off the top of my head.
Seeing no other questions, do you wish to continue?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, I think we can get Representative Kelch's information. I think Marcy presented that to the Tax Rent Committee just last week, so there's a report out there. I just looked for mine, but that's available. But I do have some questions about the fiscal note, some things that I think are missing, or one anyway. I'm under the assumption that January 1, 2013, if this thing passes, we're going to have counties, cities, townships that are going to be missing a major part of their revenue stream. All of these political subdivisions, they're on different budget cycles, but they're going through their budget cycle right now. Most of them are. They're preparing their budget for January 1, 2013, and I don't know how they're going to do it. And if June 12th it passes, and it's very likely the voters will have their say and we will react to their wisdom. But I don't know how we can be positioned without a special session. I mean, it's inevitable that some decisions are going to be made prior to us coming in next January in order for these political subdivisions to even operate in January. I don't know how else that can be there. And so I guess my question is, should this fiscal note take in any consideration to the cost of a special session? That is a cost we know we're going to incur. And I don't think that's a debatable question. I think, but I'd just like to throw that out to ask if they have given any thought to it, any concern to it. But there's decisions that got to be made before these people can operate January 1.
Well, there's a question for Kathy Strombeck. If that was considered as part of the fiscal note, which is, I think Christine Lee can answer it, I would comment as far as a special session, the only one you can call a special session now is the governor, so that is his choice. But I do agree with you that a special session would be needed for funding, for budgeting purposes. But,
we have no costs in the fiscal note, and you're absolutely right about that, Senator. But according to the statute that requires that the legislative council seek advice or fiscal information from the executive branch, we return that to the legislative branch. So we return this fiscal note to legislative council. So I certainly think it's possibly something that you could add a cost of a special session in there and still be meeting the statute that requires, you know, I mean, really, it's our delivery to you and then your delivery to Secretary of State.
Do you have any idea, Kevin Strombeck, what a cost of a, say, a week-long session, since we had a special session recently? Do we know the figures?
Mr. Chairman, I don't, but I'm certain it would be relatively easy to get the cost of last November's special session.
I think the committee would appreciate Tim probably an email notifying what that cost would be for discussion purposes and presentation.
We can check on that and get you the numbers. I can't recall off the top of my head how much the special session was, but we can get that shortly.
Thank you. Representative Wendich, you had a question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to suggest that it was probably more the responsibility of legislative council to determine the cost of a special session than of the tax department.
That's probably true, but that's what we found out. But she was outstanding at the bank, so it was a good question. Any other comments by interested people in the in the room? Seeing none.
Senator Miller. Mr. Chairman, I was just kind of wondering, with regards to the language that goes on the ballot, is that sole discretion of the Secretary of State, or is there some other input, or would we have some influence on that?
Mr. Smith, would you like to answer that question, please?
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, how the process would work, once you determine the fiscal impact, you would prepare a report that would go to the Legislative Management Committee, and they are scheduled to meet on May 1st. And then the Legislative Management Committee attaches the fiscal note prepared by the tax department and any other information, as well as does a summary statement that gets forwarded to the Secretary of State, and that's what gets attached to the ballot measure.
Mr. Chairman, the Secretary of State, is he just kind of obliged to print that, or can he make changes? Does he have that authority to basically print whatever he wants? Or,
well, Mr. Chairman, the fiscal statement that's forwarded to the Secretary of State is what gets attached. There's no changes that he makes.
Representative Wendich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as information, I have recently had some conversations with the Secretary of State's office because I was particularly interested in the ballot language on Measure 2. My understanding is that the Secretary of State drafts the descriptive language that's on the ballot, but that it has to be approved by the Attorney General, and then obviously would also include fiscal information.
Representative Forsyth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. On that fiscal impact, do we also try to estimate what it will cost in the next biennium? There's hundreds of millions of dollars worth of new school funding issues out there in Western North Dakota especially, and those requests will be coming in at the next legislative session if this passes. So are we supposed to estimate what the expenses will be required for the next biennium also? It would be no more than right to do that, some type of a rough estimate, because we're sending this to the next legislative session on a wing and a prayer if we don't.
I don't know where Ms. Strombeck wants to answer that question or not. My assumption is that we are estimating on history, and the projected growth over the years, not necessarily on what we as individuals see out there, but if you wish us to try and answer that, we'll all try it.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out again that section of code that requires that this fiscal note actually be written very clearly references 1 year, not even a full biennium. It's a 1 year, and at the end of that year, after the initiated measure, if it's enacted, there is a summary of 1 year. But what Representative Forsythe is saying is certainly a good idea, but it's probably more of the forecast and budgeting process than it is this fiscal note process.
Thank you. That clarifies. We are going to have a discussion concerning Measure 2 and what we've learned about it. Basically, because of a lawsuit that's against a number of individuals on the language they're using, I'd like to have a prompt discussion as to exactly what we've learned from, as our opinion and interpretation of Measure 2, so that we're all on the same page and when we leave this meeting. We'll do that after a break here, but Representative Williams.
Thank you. Relative to what we're discussing with the 905 item, could I have Mr. Hill approach the mic again, please?
Mr. Hill, would you be willing to approach the mic again?
Thank you.
Chairman, Representative Williams.
Thank you, sir. An important element came up this morning. It's important in my district, and I wanted to see if there's agreement on it. If Measure 2 were to pass, it would negate certain things that are in the existing law. Is it your understanding that the farm exemption would be eliminated by Measure 2?
All property taxes would be eliminated. If farm exemptions are exemptions to property taxes, those exemptions would be eliminated because there would be no property tax that they would apply to.
May I take a step forward?
You may continue.
If that were to happen, would the state then be obligated to pick up the estimated tax on farm buildings, especially the residences?
The state wouldn't be picking up the tax on any buildings. What it would do is it would be replacing the amount of money raised through property taxes that are used to pay for the legally imposed duties and obligations of the political subdivisions.
All right, thank you.
Is there any other questions before break? Representative Couch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hale. I'm just kind of wondering what you're thinking is, if say this legislature is not in session, a school building is damaged somehow, and you know, insurance doesn't cover everything, roof is leaking, do they fix it and bill the state if Measure Number 2 passes, or do they request the money from the state before they fix it and get it paid? Or just how do you envision something like that working? I mean, I guess my concern is the money going to be available, somebody administering that money sent out there immediately, or does the legislature have to meet every time there's a disaster, say, in the area?
The measure requests or calls for the legislature to devise a formula to respond to the kinds of issues that you've brought up. And I can outline a lot of options here. For example, the political subdivisions where I live, Ward County and the City of Minot, those are the major ones, as well as the school districts, those are separate political subdivisions, in their budgets, and I'm familiar with the budgets, they have contingency funds to deal with issues as you've talked about, where there's a leak, there's a problem, major disasters. All of our subdivisions have insurance that covers those types of things. So much of the tools and the processes are already in place. It's just like the state has its reserve funds for emergencies, and when things happen, when there's out of sessions, you have committees that have been empowered, have the authority to make decisions to address these issues and to fund those. That already exists, and I would presume, as a part of the formula, you would continue that and apply it as is necessary to make this work. But the formula is in the hands of this legislature, or the legislature.
Again, I remind people to keep arguing the fiscal note and the impact that it would have on the fiscal notes. And Representative Ruby.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to ask the question, give Mr. Hale, I would appreciate if you would respond to the discussion that Mr. Erickson brought up about the market value of personal property that's worded in the bill, and if you could give your responses to what you believe that language means.
Well, first of all, the language relative to the determination of the value of property in the state of North Dakota, the purpose of that determination is to set the bonding limits for the state. It's not to assess any taxes, first of all. That's the purpose, that's what that section is all about, determining how much bonding the state is authorized to do, because there's a constitutional limitation on that, and it's based upon valuation of property. In terms of how, and I think Senator Cook probably addressed that pretty effectively when he said what he thought would happen is this legislature would identify how they would go about assessing that, and you can set whatever formula you thought would be appropriate and make sense. If somebody wanted to challenge that, they could, and the courts would determine the appropriateness of it. But how you do that, and again, I have a feeling that Senator Cook would probably have that ready to go. Based on his comments, and that's probably how it would be addressed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hale.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Smith.
There was a question about the cost of the special session, and it was approximately $250,000, and that's for 5 legislative days, so we can, rough estimates for a special session are about $50,000 a day.
Thank you, Mr. Knudsen. I think at this time the committee will take a 15-minute break and then we'll go into committee discussion. We'll go back in at 25 minutes to 11 according to that clock on the wall. I'll call the committee back order, and I do want to make one correction. I stated to Ms. Beeler earlier, I got confused between the Fighting Sioux lawsuit and the Measure 2, but the meaning behind it was the same. I had stated that the legislative management had hired an attorney to defend the people's right to vote. That was in the case of the Fighting Sioux, but I think it shows the intent of the legislature that we do defend the people's right to vote. That was not a Measure 2. Having said that, I'd like to have the committee discuss. As you know, there's been some legal action taken against individuals pertaining to what the meaning of Measure 2, and the effect of Measure 2. And I would like to go through and state what I think I've learned from testimony over the last 3 or 4 meetings, how Measure 2 is going to be implemented and what effect it has, and then I would ask the committee to either add or correct my thoughts, which hopefully are your thoughts, as to what we've learned about Measure 2. First of all, for no objection to the committee, of course. First of all, Measure 2 does eliminate most property tax, general property tax. It does not eliminate general levies or general special levy property tax. Those are still, that are currently in effect, legal obligations, and local political subdivisions are going to be required to pay for those obligations. We did talk about how political subdivisions can raise additional funds. We learned that if they're home rule, they will be able to put on sales tax, or they will be able to put on income tax, local income tax. They will be able to continue with special levies for special projects because it's not based on the value of the property. there is a concern that there is not any way in the laws, once this passes, to, for giving them the ability to collect money to make that obligation. That simply would have to be addressed later. It does go into effect January 1st, 2012. Their tax, some of the taxes, industrial and utility tax are gone, but the transmission line stays, tax stays. Mobile home tax is gone, but crew housing tax is still in place, unless, of course, the legislature addresses these. Pipeline taxes are gone, but payment of new business taxes still, new businesses stay in effect, so that in lieu of it have to be paid. Cost savings, we learned that it's anywhere from, I believe it was $5 million that the county first said, and there's up to $50 million has been reported in testimony. That figure is what was given to testimony. We don't really have any factual information to back it up, but that's what we learned. Funding will be based on the 2012 property tax, and after the growth that was in the 2012 estimate, any additional growth would be at the discretion of the legislature. 2013 funding cannot be determined until after the legislature convened, and would be at their discretion what the funding would be after the measure passes. Schools would be granted the current dollars that they receive through property tax. That money would be up to their sole discretion to spend. However, that money is in the budget now because it's part of their spending process, and it's not any additional dollar. In layman's terms, we fund 70% of the school funding. They fund 30% through local property tax or other means. We would be obligated to fund the 30%. The 70% is again still at our discretion. Well, personally, I don't feel that we ever see a cut in that, but that is at our at the legislature's discretion. Schools, of course, cannot bond, and so therefore any construction, new construction, would be at the discretion of the legislature. Legally imposed obligations are a very important term in there. Legally imposed obligations are determined by the state legislature or the courts, if the courts happen to intervene on a court case. Fully and properly funding is determined by the legislature, unless again the court steps in. Expenditures, or there's a sentence in there that's expenditures in the sole discretion of the governing boards of the political subdivision. That's true of the money that the legislature decided to get. That's the way I interpret it. Political subdivisions can budget whatever amount they want, but it'll be the legislature determine the amount that they receive. And that's how I interpreted the testimony given to us by our legal counsel. If I missed something, I would like to know about it so that I don't go out in the public and give any information that is false. But that is so far the interpretation I've got, and I think there's additional, I think, so you can add. Representative Forsyth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You keep better notes than I do. Could we have those bullet points sent, emailed to us, all committee members?
Well, I think those bullet points, if anything you want to add on to this, we can have sent out, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Elke.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if I could ask a question of someone from the tax department. Kathy or Marcy or whoever wants to jump up. Hi, Kathy. Could you answer a question for me? I was wondering if there's any taxes that are currently being paid under protest with the idea that maybe they're going to be a challenge to should they have to pay that tax or not.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elke, yes, that's a very good question, and there certainly are taxes. The ones that I'm aware of are coal conversion taxes that are being paid currently under protest and have been since the first of the year. There may be others. Let me just check with Marcy.
Not aware of them.
So just the coal conversion? There's coal conversion, so that's a good question.
Okay, so I think I understand the coal conversion tax, but there's also something called the shortfall, conversion shortfall tax. Can you explain to the committee how that works?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no, actually, I can't. Is there somebody? Marcy can.
Okay, that'd be great. Super.
Marcy, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Marcy Dickerson. I'm State Supervisor of Assessments.
Good morning, Marcy.
Good morning. excuse me. Coal conversion shortfall tax isn't really a tax, it's something that's made up by the state. A number of years ago, the legislature passed language that if any county received less revenue from coal conversion compared to the year immediately preceding, the state would make up the difference. That happened at the time that, for one reason or another, I forget what the specific reason was, the gasification plant was producing a lot less revenue than it had in the prior year, and it was meant to take care of Mercer County, which would be receiving less money from coal conversion than it had before. And the other entity that benefits from it is Morton County. The Heska plant used to be just part of MDU's operating property. It did not qualify as a coal conversion plant. It changed, or you changed the requirements so that a small plant like the Heska plant could become a coal conversion plant, and put in the language that every year Morton County would have to receive the same amount of revenue that they did when that plant was just a regular property tax paying plant. So as it is, the total coal conversion tax that the Morton County plant, the Heska plant, pays now is approximately the same as what the property tax was that it used to pay. But since there's a division in the coal conversion between 15% to the state and 85% to the county, or vice versa, the state now is paying most of that, what they get in, back to Morton County to replace the property tax. So it's just a replacement of formerly received money that no longer is being received.
So Marcy, then, if the coal conversion tax that's being paid under protest now, for instance, goes away because the judge decides that's the way it should be, then is the state would be obligated for that, more of that conversion shortfall then, wouldn't? Does that stand to reason, or would it all even out? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Elke, for one thing, the gasification plant has been paying more revenue to the state and to the county in the past few years. So for a couple of years, there hasn't been any shortfall payment to Mercer County. So I would say at this point, there wouldn't be anything for the state to kick in there, because the conversion tax itself is in lieu of property tax, but it's not based on value. So according to John Walstead's memo, that coal conversion tax would not be going away. So I don't think the state would be obligated to replace anything there, because that might be subject to litigation.
But wouldn't it make the state responsible to all those counties to make up the coal conversion tax distributions that they wouldn't be receiving, that shortfall is supposedly supposed to do?
Well,
we have to pay it all to them then?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Elke, it's possible. With that wording, I would assume that the legislature might choose to change the wording in that section under that circumstance, because at the present time, it's only applying to Morton County, assuming that nothing makes any other county lose money. I mean, if a plant blew up in McLean County, like one of the Coal Creek plants had an accident a number of years ago, if McLean got less money, then the state would be obligated to make up the difference under the existing language. But how that would work, I mean, I really don't know, since this is not an in lieu of property tax based on value. I don't know as Measure 2 would really have anything to do with that particular section.
And your crystal ball isn't any better than ours is, probably. So would it make sense for us to have some kind of fiscal numbers, and perhaps on
on just that, at least that segment of, you know, what's happening out there in terms of taxes?
Well, I can certainly get that for you. I don't know if it would make sense to put in for Mercer County anymore, because under current circumstances, it doesn't look like there will be any need for a state payment to Mercer County in the future. It'd just be Martin.
Sure. Okay.
The interpretation that we as a committee are under is that the coal conversion tax stays, so it is not included in the fiscal note, but it is a very important note. If the coal conversion tax is ruled as included in the property tax and no longer able to collect, and the legislature went in and changed it, the time period from the 1st of January when the measure 2 goes into effect to the time period that the legislature passes new language so that it's not included in the property tax measure, any monies that would have been collected in that period of time would be refunded. We cannot go back and collect from the 1st of January if we pass it the 1st of January of next year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's probably correct. Legal advice would probably be more definite than that.
Okay. And I'm really surprised and lucky that you questioned Mercy's wisdom.
I said she had a crystal ball.
No better than ours. Representative Medcap.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a situation here that I think I know what the answer is, but I'm going to ask this committee here and ask yourself just to get some idea. We have had in our district, school district that has put up an issue for building a new school. And they've done that three times, and they got voted down three times. And of course, there's a 60% requirement when you're, for something like this type of voting. And it failed by about 2% each time, about 2%. Well, the board in its wisdom felt, well, there's another way of getting around this, and that's to put it out to a private bid, or I don't know exactly how they got around it. And you're probably more aware of it than I am, so, but they are now in the process of building a new school. I don't know that if they have put up the value of the property there as a basis for this, or if they've actually can build a school on their own loss, or if the school can't pay it, are the people that are involved, are they going to assume the responsibility there for paying that bill?
Representative Medcap, I'm going to let Mr. Knudsen try to answer that. But we did have a discussion concerning some school districts that leased lease purchase agreements where a third party built a building and they leased it for a number of years and then purchased it for a dollar or two at the end of that lease. And it was not considered a bond issue against the against the school district, and at first we would be liable to pay because they were collecting that from general obligation levies, and we would be able to pay that, but then the legislature would determine what is legal obligation, and it would be up to them to determine if they would continue to refund that. That was my interpretation, Mr. Knudsen, maybe you got a better one.
So, no, that is my thoughts exactly. Is that, you know, it just depends on how it's structured, but if it's determined to be a legally imposed obligation, then the state would be required to continue to make those payments.
Representative Zizer.
Thank you. I was just going to concur with the comments made here. What I think you have here is we've talked about in a couple of sessions, is where since they couldn't get it passed by the 60%, I had tried to get legislation through so that we could pass it on 50%. But anyway, there's a private nonprofit then. The school district sells the property to the private nonprofit, and by the very nature that it's private, it doesn't have to go through the voting process, and therefore it gets done. There's no voting because it's private. And so, but in terms of the liability, the local community won't be, as I understand it, wouldn't be liable. I'm talking to John Wellstead for any kind of default because it's not public. The school district is simply leasing the buildings on a perpetual lease.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Elkin brought up a good point. Earlier, one of our earlier meetings, this committee posed 30-some questions to the Attorney General, questions about Measure 2 that we didn't have answers for. We still don't have answers for many of those, most of them probably. We have a legislative council interpretation of them, but we still don't have a legal opinion or a definite answer on what direction to take on many of those 30-some questions we posed. And as we go forward and if Measure 2 passes, we need an opinion. Is it up to the Attorney General to make an opinion on all those gray areas before the legislature can continue and move forward with passing the legislation that's needed for the framework of a life without property taxes?
Representative Pearson, if you remember, as you remember correctly, we did ask the Attorney General for opinions on those questions, and he did answer us. Do you remember the wording on his answer, Mr. Knudsen?
Mr. Chairman, I believe he stated because it wasn't law, he wasn't going to speak to it. So if the measure was approved, I would think at some point after it becomes law, if certain questions were posed to him, he would potentially respond to those.
So we have to wait to pass before we can submit those questions to him for his legal opinion. Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, I agree. I think we go through this all the time. We are challenged with following the Constitution. Everything we pass here, we're passing with the intent that we are following the Constitution. He's certainly going to defend us if we are challenged. But I think what comes out of this, we have Mr. Walstead has answered those 30 questions. He's our legal counsel, and he's given us our answer. I think we also all know that for every attorney's opinion, there's another attorney who has a different opinion. And I think that the memorandum that Mr. Walstead drafted and that we all agree to, I mean, it's very clear that a lot of these discussion or decisions that we're going to have to be made are probably going to be challenged. I think if there's one fact that needs to come out of here is there is going to be a certain amount of litigation that will probably follow our decisions. Ultimately, we might be proven to be the wisest, or that Mr. Walstead's advice to us was the best advice, and that we will win and prevail on every one of those decisions. We don't know, but there will be, I think, and that's a fact that I consider a fact as I've listened to all of the debates here, is that there's going to be a certain amount of litigation that will be followed after our decisions are made. And, you know, we got to accept that. If the voters of North Dakota say that they think the state will be better off with income tax and sales tax rather than the three-legged tax stool, then we will deliver that. We will have to deliver that. And we're going to have to make a whole lot of decisions on how to deliver that, and there will be some of them that will get challenged. And ultimately, we will end up, you know, with court decision, and courts finally putting their blueprint on what it is, but we will end up with a two-legged tax stool. So I think if there's one thing that we got to agree on is there will be some litigation. The other thing I want to bring up, and I want to go back to the school tax, and I don't know if we really got into it that hard here, but I sit on, we have another committee, of course, that it's a joint tax and education committee, and we had the folks in Power North Dakota testify before that committee also, more specifically on how, for example, a new school district or a school district would move forward with a school plan or plan to build a new school. And there was good testimony on that. And I think that part of our record ought to include the minutes from the very first meeting of that education and tax committee meeting. And when I walked away from that minutes or from that meeting with after listening to Charlene Nelson give her explanation of how a school district might build a new school, it's obvious to me that another fact is that school districts are still going to need a local source of revenue. Her testimony was it'll be special taxes. I assume that meant special assessments. And if you pull up the minutes, and I'm sure we could all have them in front of us here yet this morning, you know, school districts cannot levy special assessments today. It's against the law, and it's against the law for reasons. But it is obvious to me that no matter how we move forward, we're going to make decisions here on what we want to fund for education. But there still has to be a local source of revenue for them to fund what they in that own school district want that the legislature can legally say is not necessary, and therefore we're not funding it. They still may want to fund it. And I believe she agreed with her testimony. So I think that's a fact, that school districts will still need a local source of revenue. I think it's a question of what that local source would be. We don't know. That will be one of our decisions that we will have to make, and we'll have to make it real quick if this passes. So I would like to suggest that be added to it. And then, Mr. Chairman, I heard you early on when you were giving your suggestions on the facts. You said something about local income tax. Could you say that again and refresh me on that?
Well, I'm under the impression that homeowners can put a local income tax on them. Am I incorrect on that?
I would say you are incorrect on that.
Okay.
And I know I had questions about it. I've heard this discussion before. Our tax commissioner, I received an email from him, and maybe that needs to be put into the record. Maybe he could present that in the form of testimony. But he did have some research done on that, and it's pretty clear in my mind that local governments, even in rule, cannot levy income tax without some decision by the legislature to give them the right to do so. But as of today, they cannot. And we certainly need to have that as part of our record and to clarify it. I think that could be a decision that we, as we move forward with our property tax, the legislature might decide that we're going to have to give them that authority. That would all be part of our deliberations as we try to, you know, reinvent this rule. But I'd say today they cannot.
Well, thank you. That's why I wanted to do bullet points, so that we all understood this the same thing. And you did add some very interesting bullet points a second. First, the school, the kid that came up in special session, I did miss that one, I forgot to mention. The other thing I wanted to mention was that John Ralston's interpretation, which, as you pointed out, is the interpretation we have to go by. He is our legal counsel. He presented here in this room, and we asked for comments from the general public, and the only comments we got from the general public was that people agreed, and that included the Public Taxpayer Committee, that they agreed with Mr. Ralston's comments on it. The other point is litigation. That's a point that should be added, that that there will be litigation, or I'm pretty sure there will be litigation on it. And if I could read my writing, I can give the other one, but we'll come back to that. But those are good points, sir. I appreciate it. Senator Soding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is probably a question directed at Senator Cook or anyone else that sits on that Tax Education Committee. But my understanding is they might have to come up with an additional revenue, whether it's special assessments or something, if they want to build. But the state is still obligated for all bonds the way this thing is written, and I understand it. Whatever bonds are issued, we're going to be obligated. So wouldn't they still have to come to the legislature for approval? In other words, instead of worrying if you're getting 60% of the vote, even if 80% of the people in the community want a new school, they're not going to get it unless the legislature has a vote and approves it. Now, maybe I'm not understanding that, but if we're obligated to the bond, even if they come up with a different source of revenue, can they issue a bond without our approval? And that's a question I just don't quite understand as this conversation evolved.
Well, if somebody else wishes to answer that, to be great, but the way I understood it, and Mr. Kaminsky can follow up on this, is that if there's a bond, there's nothing backing that bond, and nobody can buy that bond, and the funding would have to come from the state, so therefore the state would have to approve the money. Now, even if they approved the 90%, you may continue.
Thank you. Well, then the addition and a special assessment is more of a revenue bond. Would they be able to issue that without the state's approval? Would we be obligated to guarantee the revenue bonds?
Mr. Kaminsky, I'll let you answer. Well, we're not obligated to the ones they currently, the state's not obligated to the ones they currently issue.
Future. I'm asking
the future.
Future.
Mr. Chairman, I believe if the city and county issued a revenue bond, they would still be the ones liable for that because the revenue source would be at the local level, and I don't believe the state would be required to guarantee that.
another point, another point that you brought up that I missed to suggest you mentioned was that, as you all know, that we went through some challenges on school funding, inequity of school funding in recent years. That was based on value per student in local school districts, and without property tax evaluation, there is no value per student, and that may throw that equity sentiment, and Mr. Dennis Johnson brought that up in his testimony, in the legality again. Any other discussion points on Representative Dunwich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of comments. With respect to the bonding issue, it seems to me that the major problem is one of uncertainty. Not so much with, you know, what is said, but how the private bond market might react. Because at the present time, when a municipality issues a bond, and it's backed by certain tax levies and so on, we have that structure is well known in the private market, and bonding companies are willing to loan money on that basis. If Measure 2 passes, that source of revenue will not be there anymore. If a municipality does issue a bond, it will have to be backed by some other form of collateral. And no one really knows whether the private bond market will accept that collateral or not. And so it's more a question of uncertainty than it is just what's going to happen. And I think that's one of the points that needs to come out about this, that we've learned that there are a lot of these areas of uncertainty. And I was also going to comment about the income tax. There was a bill introduced, I believe it was in the 2001 session, that would have authorized home rule cities to levy a local income tax. I remember it well because it was introduced by my colleague, Representative Glasheim. That bill was not only defeated by the legislature, but my recollection is that there was an alternative bill prohibiting such an income tax that was passed. So I believe at the present time it's impossible without further legislative action.
I believe I was corrected on that earlier.
And one other comment, or something that no one else has mentioned. One of the things that I think we might include in our bullet points is the situation that will arise with respect to privately owned utility, or I can't think of the name, investor-owned electric companies and rural electric cooperatives. Because the private utilities pay property taxes, which would go away if Measure 2 passes, but the rural electrics do not. They pay, in lieu of property taxes, a gross receipts tax. And if I understand Mr. Walstead's memo correctly, that would not be repealed. So we would have a situation where two very comparable business structures are taxed completely. One is not taxed at all, and the other is pretty much going to maintain the current tax structure. Again, unless the legislature takes very quick action.
I do believe I mentioned that when I said that the investor-owned utility tax is gone, but the transmission rate stays, and that's the inequity that is put in there. Thank you for you did a much better job in discussing the schools revenue bond than I did. I just said you wouldn't be able to do it. You are correct. Revenue bonds are based on the ability to raise revenue, and the testimony given by a gentleman, a bond expert, at one of our hearings, did state, as you did, that if there isn't any revenue to back the bond, no one's going to buy the bonds, and therefore the ability to sell revenue bonds is gone. And the only way that they'll be able to reinstate that is the legislature comes up with a source of revenue that they can put on locally to back those bonds. So you clarified that much better than I did. Representative Ruby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any problems with your notes and your bullet points. It did allude to something that I had also brought up in the past, and it was, you know, who would decide, and it would certainly be the legislature that would decide legal obligations for improper funding and those kind of things. And I had requested one time that we take this advantage of this committee, since we, you know, have all of the interested parties, all of the players, cities, counties, townships, schools, everyone involved in following this committee, that we would take that advantage to start to define the legal obligations that they would expect, that would be part of the responsibility of the legislature, and then also to work on some formulas. And you know, I would hope that the reason we didn't go down that road is so that by doing so we wouldn't remove some of the opposition or some of the doubt or the unknown consequences or the fear of the unknown that some of the entities have. But that being said, you know, I think it's something that we've been derelict in doing, is that we have the advantage to start working on that. Certainly we don't need to develop legislation at this point, because that would require you know, a lot of time and that, but we could at least start identifying and defining those areas that could be put into legislation later. I will be emailing everybody a proposal of a formula that will work, potentially. It's all for discussion, and I would hope at a further later meeting we could get into a discussion, and maybe there'll be more options and formulas and proposals that could be before us, that we would be a little bit proactive before the vote. If the vote turns out it's defeated, you know, then we'll sign and die this committee, and no further action will be taken, and any of the responsibilities of making proposals on property tax changes will fall on the other committee. But you know, I would think that it wouldn't hurt us to kind of go down that road a little bit, be a little bit proactive, a little bit ahead of the curve. If it does pass, then we've got that much work established, and it would save us a little bit of work and crunch time between June and probably September or August, August, September, when we normally would wrap up an interim committee.
We tried to identify some of it as far as it affects the fiscal role, which is our primary responsibility. I have asked Legislative Council a number of times, or at least the head of Legislative Council, if we should go into trying to identify some language bills that need to be drafted, and they were told that we were not going to spend the tax money, we were doing that until the taxpayers tell us what direction they want to go. So I don't believe we will get into any of that at this time. Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, there is one other issue I think that we've talked about, but I think we need to take just one more look at it, and from a different perspective, and that's the issue of this bonded indebtedness, and the fact that in the memo, Mr. Walsted believes that because of the contract law and the U.S. Constitution and the North Dakota Constitution, that those contracts have to be honored, and that we've got to continue to have property valuations and the property tax there to cover those 62, I think, political subdivisions I heard that have general obligation bonds. These are not the revenue bonds, these are the general obligation bonds. So, but what does that actually mean to local governments? Imagine if you're the mayor of any city and or on a county commission, and Measure 2 passes, do you lay off your assessors? And I would suggest that you do not. And if you understand the whole property tax system, you know, February 15th is the deadline, I think, for all property to have its value determined. That's an ongoing process. By October 15th, they generally have their budgets, they apply the mill levy, and we know what the taxes are. I would suggest that, just for clarity, that local governments do not do anything to change what they're doing with property tax until the legislature was to actually meet and choose to give them, you know, the certain outcome of what it is we're going to do. I know Mr. Walsted says we've got to continue. I would believe that we could say, yeah, you know, that's your opinion, but we're going to try to do it this other way. I mean, because I really look at having, if the voters in North Dakota don't want to have property tax, I consider it to be a real unjustifiable consequence that we would have to continue to have that expense, the $10 million we were told, to raise $22 million in property tax. Because that's what we've been told today is our payment. That doesn't make sense. But it may be just what we're required to do. That might be what we're required to do. And I've sat down and I've tried to think of another way we could do it. I've talked to many people. And I've come up to one conclusion, and this is my personal conclusion, is there are other ways we could do it, but no matter which way we choose, chances are it's ultimately going to be decided by a court. And but you know what? That's really the first decision we're going to make. I mean, we almost got to know that before we start going down the road of what else can follow. And so I would certainly hope that we cross that bridge real quick, and I'm doing everything to make sure that we're prepared to cross that bridge. But I think the only point of what I'm saying here is that as this committee finishes its work before the vote, if the vote passes, that a message is here that, you know, don't stop doing what you're doing until the legislature makes it clear that you no longer need to do that.
Thank you. Representative Ruby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too, have also thought about that, not only with the bonds, but also with specials. And right now, that's based on valuations of increase as well. And I, you know, I'm not that I'm an expert at it either, but I, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be on valuation. It could be in square footage of lot, could be on number of lots. You know, there's other ways that could be done that wouldn't necessarily require an evaluation of the property.
Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, special assessments have nothing to do with evaluate or property value. Special assessments are assessed strictly based on the benefit the property owner receives,
correct,
either by square footage or linear front footage.
Committee, have any other comments or bullet points I'd like to address? I would like to say this, as you pointed out, there were 28,000 people that are upset with their property tax, and we're willing enough to sign and put their name on the ballot. There's some important issues out there that we're bringing forward, whether the measure passes or fails, and especially if the measure fails, then as legislatures, we certainly should be aware of and to see if we can continue to address them. As was pointed out, there's been many bills over the last decade in the legislature trying to make the property tax fairer, better or any way you want to say it. Some of those are the dissatisfaction you got against the property tax abatements, against the tax fine, the Renaissance Zone, some of the exemptions that have been given out. There's been in the paper comments that these tuition pass because of the college tuition that's given away on non-resident students, so that is something, as we know, we don't have any say over it, but they're saying taxpayers' dollars are being wasted, and it's something that the legislature should at least see if there's some way they can address that. And they keep saying that, well, this one kind of bothered me a little bit, is you own your home, you have to keep paying for it. And saying, why should anyone in a free country be forced to answer home? Well, one thing that does bother me a little bit, this country stands on freedom, the freedom right to have free speech, free religion, right to gather. That's not an interpretation of dollars. That free does not mean free as far as dollars goes. And it's a right to do those kind of things. A lot of people have paid in their lives to keep our freedoms. That's the type of free that this country is based on, more than a dollar bill. Well, we all know freedom is not free. There's a price to it. So I hope when we use the word free in arguing this, we do a difference between the two beyond respect for the veterans and so forth. Other than that, I've got, as we'll put that bulletin point together, check again to make sure the Representative Leonard's comments are in there and Senator Cook's comments are also included in there, and we'll get that out. The public, general public asks us questions concerning Measure 2, we will tell the facts as we lay them here in this committee. And having said that, we are not going to sign a die. We will recess. Our report will be written up. We'll have a motion to have a report written up for Legislative Management and presented to them. And we will wait for further instruction from Legislative Management whether we can reconvene for any other information they may want before the vote, or reconvene after the vote if Measure 2 should pass to start they're working on the legislation to implement Measure 2 and to correct some of the oversight that was has been discovered in the language of Measure 2 concerning the collection special tax and assessments and bonding issues and stuff like that. Any other comments before we ask for a motion to adjourn? Appreciate all your time and your efforts. I think we've had some real good discussion. I think we're understanding the measure much better, and we know the fiscal impact according to the way we do fiscal impact. So with that, I would, are we ready?
We need to entertain. We have to have the motion.
Yeah, are we ready for a motion to adjourn and a report be prepared for Legislative Costa and all upon our findings, Representative Metcalf? So moved. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right, motion carries, and we are adjourned.
No, I didn't say that.